Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you, sir?
Good day, good night. Well, hello to all. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Got a treat for you folks. We got hashtag Big Polo in the building. Hashtag Big Live.
Wait a minute.
What a treat. Nikias reporting live from Live.
I don't like this shit at all.
How do you have those noise canceling headphones working so well, man? Like, can you like tell me how you get those?
This is incredible.
Like, how do you tune out all the nightclub noise? It's amazing.
This is an awful.
Jesus Christ, man.
This is an awful bit.
How do you get a deal to always do a pod in like the back closet? Like, it's crazy.
I don't like any of this. I am, contrary to popular belief among the cast tonight, I am not at a nightclub or any club of the sort. I am in Miami. I just left the Heat Celtics game, which was an abomination to offensive basketball in the year of our Lord Savior 2021. But other than that, I'm doing well. The other voice you heard was Mike Prada, formerly of SB Nation. He's currently writing a book. Has a Substack that you should absolutely subscribe to. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm not in the nightclub, unfortunately. So I guess I got to get on your level.
Okay.
See the guys. It's a little past my bedtime to be in a nightclub.
The nightclub spot. This is we're already off the rails and we're like not even 5 minutes in.
I think you're the first person to ever vehemently deny that you're in a nightclub. Like, no, that is not me. I do not do that. Like, how many people your age deny being in a nightclub?
Probably not many, but, you know, it's fine. Dare to be different. It is what it is.
That's how seriously he takes his craft, guys.
There you go. You can't break, you know, you can't explain Spain pick and rolls in a nightclub. Or at least I would imagine that you can. I don't know.
Oh, man, I'd love to see that.
We have Mike on today because Steve has been hinting at Wizards talk for like 2 weeks now. And so I figured, why not get the resident Wizards guy? Well, that's selling Mike short, honestly. Like, Mike has an eye for the NBA at large, but the Wizards are near and dear to his heart, or at least at the very least, they're near to his heart. Are they also dear to your heart, or have they upset you enough over the years to where they're not so dear?
I would say they're more dear to my heart than near to my heart at this point since I'm in New York, but no, they're still dear to my heart. Okay. I can't quit them, man. It's the family tradition. Like, you know, when they win and when they're competent, you know, when they look like a real basketball team instead of the Russell Westbrook show, like I can say, like, well, I lived through the Russell Westbrook show. This looks awesome.
Sheesh. Russ catching a stray very early on. Before we dig into the actual show, a quick question for you, Mike. How many games have you watched this year?
Let's see. I have to update. Like you said, like all NBA, right? Not just Wizards games.
Yes, I watched
every Wizards game. I have to do an update. I'm in the middle of... Let me just update my spreadsheet and then I'll get back to you real quick.
This is all I want to convey to the audience. Mike has a spreadsheet that tracks every game that he watches every season. And this database goes back to what, 2012, 2013, somewhere in that range?
Not quite that far, 2015. But yeah, it's gone back a while. Let's see, today is November 4th, so I got to fill in all the ones I watched yesterday. I think I watched like four yesterday that I haven't gotten to. I think I'm at like 63. I might be in the middle of my 64th right now, watching Bulls 76ers last night.
This is insane dedication.
Cannot wait for someone to tell you you don't watch games.
Oh, it happens. It happens.
That it's like one of the more underrated bits in NBA Twitter when Mike has an opinion and someone's like, you clearly don't watch this team. And he just drops the spreadsheet. So it's like, well, actually, not only do I watch your favorite team, I can tell you how many times I watched them and what games I watched them in. Like, it's.
Look, it's just a lot easier than like just saying, oh, I clearly watch your team. Like, I just present the facts. You can do what you want. I did remember somebody, you know, I dropped something about some thought on Lonzo Ball and why, like how the Pelicans let him go. And I dropped the spreadsheet after someone disagreed with me. It was like, you clearly don't watch Lonzo Ball. And I had a lot of people respond and be like, oh my God, you only watched 20% of Lonzo Ball's career pro games. And I'm like, yeah, in addition to all the other stuff. Also, start to finish every single one in order. Like, I guarantee you, like, you're not watching that. You're not doing that.
It's not an easy thing to do, even for the most avid NBA lovers. So, like, I don't know. Like, I try not to let noise on Twitter get to me that much. But, like, that is the one thing that irks me. If someone disagrees with you, it's not just, I disagree and here's why. It's, you just don't watch. Like, don't.
You have so many other things to, like, throw at me about how stupid I am. Like, you choose that? Like, I just like, kind of am trying to help you out here, man. Like, there's a lot of other stuff. Like, oh, you haven't played the game. Yeah, like, I screwed up my back and I can't play very much. So, yeah, that's a fair one. Like, go with that. But, like, you don't watch the games? I mean, like, that's, like, people look at that and they're like, you've canceled plans to watch games. You've avoided me to watch games. Like, that is the most just inaccurate. Like, come on, insult me correctly. That's all I ask.
It's a disrespect to the crowd. All right. We have had a bit of a busy Thursday. Phoenix in particular has had a pretty busy Thursday. We did get quite an article that came out from Baxter Holmes of ESPN detailing some of the alleged toxicity in the Phoenix Suns organization, more so pointed at Robert Sarver. Steve, what were your initial thoughts when that came through the pipeline?
70 plus people. That was my initial thought, 70 plus. And it took me almost 2 hours to read it. I guess I got triggered and was upset and it zapped me for the rest of the day. So what he did, he's got to go. I'll keep it simple there. He's got to go. That's, you can't do that in any way, shape, or form. On a lighter note, Earl Watson making fun of him for drawing plays that had pick and rolls in the middle of the paint did make me chuckle.
That was good.
I got a kick out of that.
The rest of it was just the audacity. Like, it's gross, man. It's not a world I want to live in. And the whole back and forth, denying the allegations, but with so many people corroborating details of this, is bad, man. Can't double down on saying so. I don't even want to. No.
Like, the story.
But how do we know that Robert Sarver just wasn't like a huge fan of like super snug pick and rolls? This is like not a funny story, but we're just trying.
Oh, Jesus. Like, where do you start that? You have a screen being set at like the restricted area. Like, I don't know what that even looks like on a whiteboard.
Yeah. You know what? Like, I don't even want to think about it.
Neither did he. That, never mind. I'm going to get mad again.
I'll just say, like, at a base level, like, it's very unfortunate. Like, it's hard to, I'm with you, Steve, like 70 plus people being interviewed with this. Like, that seems like that's a whole lot of smoke at the very least. The story kicks off with an instance of the N-word being said. And I'm just like, if this is the tone setter of the piece, like, I don't know where this is going. And sure enough, it got worse and worse and worse. And it was a mixture of Sarver and his representation saying, no, this didn't happen, or no, you're losing the context of what happened. And it's just like, you stack up all these incidents. Like, if a fourth of them are true, you shouldn't be near an NBA organization, much less all of them. And so the NBA has opened up an investigation into the organization. So I'm curious to see where that goes.
That's just like so ridiculous. I'm sorry. Like, oh, you guys didn't know any of this stuff was happening? Like, it's just striking to me how much the reaction to the story was sort of like, oh, finally the open secret around the league is out. This guy is a fuckhead. I don't know. There's something about that that like sits weirdly with me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I keep thinking about like compared to like Donald Sterling, right? That was so much more blatant and out in the open that it's not like it had to be an open secret. But, you know, all of these things and all of these connections that happened, like, there had to have been a lot of people who knew about this. And yet it took this long for someone to compile it and corroborate it all together. I just wonder, I mean, maybe this is more of a media question, and I think obviously you have to be careful with it, but it's just, it does kind of call into question, like, ousting Sterling was like such a no-brainer because in addition to all the fucked stuff he did in an NBA context, he was doing all this stuff in a non-NBA context. So, like, I mean, that was simpler. I mean, this was, I mean, all of these things that are happening in this context, I just fall under the, like, kind of overarching umbrella of, like, God, what a fucking terrible person.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really, like, I don't want to say that it's like better than Sterling or worse than Sterling, but I think it's interesting that people knew about a lot of these things, but only now that they're seen together does the whole picture come to focus and be like, wow, this guy's are really, really fucking messed up.
It's the underbelly of sports.
Yeah. It's just interesting that it took so long for this to come out. I think the second that like Sarver was like preemptively denying stories, you knew it was really messed up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, I mean, at that point, like you kind of knew that like it had to have been really bad. I am curious, like sort of what the next steps are, both from an NBA perspective, you know, and what all the other owners think about this. Cause ultimately, you know, those are the people that oust a person from office. And, you know, the other, of course, really messed up thing about it is that the guys who now have to answer for it are people like Monty Williams, James Jones, and all the players. And now they have it's almost, again, that just sucks.
Yeah, the James Jones inclusion is interesting to me. Like, I didn't expect him to be cited in the story. Like, he already kind of made the statement once Sarver made his preemptive statement before the story even dropped. And so for him to also be quoted in this, and kind of go at Earl Watson a little bit was something that surprised me. And so, like, I'm also curious to see, like, what the reaction is going to be like with the players themselves. So I know, like, Chris Paul in particular is going to be asked about it since he was in Los Angeles when the Donald Sterling thing went down. And now the Sarver story comes out and he's there. And so I feel like that's, like, obviously it's not his fault or anything like that. But I wonder, like, how he feels having to deal with this kind of weirdness, to be kind, and ownership in two different places.
I mean, Steve, as someone who's actually worked for an NBA team, like I imagine, I mean, this is obviously an extreme example, but like, how much can we expect from Monty Williams, James Jones, the people who are employed by the Suns, who undoubtedly knew that this guy was a total fuckhead, but you know, it's a job's a job. Like, what responsibility do they have to answer for him? And is all of what's going on that's going to happen with all of them, like, is it all unfair? Like, I don't know the answer to these questions.
Well, the gig is the gig. So they're going to have to face the music, unfortunately, for this. And to answer part of your question, think about how and why it took so long for it to come out and the number of people that came out but weren't able to put their names on it. That should speak volumes. It's an industry where built on connections, trying to stick around, and you're trying to toe the line. So you have a responsibility to speak your truth, but you also work there. So it becomes difficult sometimes to navigate that correctly, in which you may not have experienced that, so it may not speak to you. But you have all this evidence, and now you can be painted in a way that may not be fair. I feel for them for having to answer those type of questions. I feel for Monty Williams, person who he is, to have to face that kind of music on something that really doesn't have anything to do with him. Now he can be painted in a different light Hopefully it doesn't, but it's wild. It's wild.
It's unfortunate all the way around. Tough to segue from that into actual basketball discussion, but we are going to have to try to do that. Other piece of news before we dig into the Wizards a bit, LeBron James is hurt again. I'm going to be out for at least a week dealing with an abdominal strain. I can talk. How worried are you? I'll start with you, Steve. How worried are you about the general wear and tear with LeBron at this point? Like, is this finally the age catching up to him a bit?
I don't know if it's catching up to him. I mean, it's a lot of nicks that he's had over the years when he was kind of quote unquote indestructible. So I think it's just natural father time knocking on his door. I also think it's clear the Lakers are going to play it as safe as they can with him. Just based on last year, knowing when they'll need him and how much they'll need him. I think he's almost in bubble wrap a little bit. So I think it's more of a deal where they want to make sure he's right at the right time. I think he wants to make sure he's right at the right time, and they're going to take whatever measures they can. Obviously, the injuries kind of keep piling up in minor ways, and you definitely want to hope that he can get into a rhythm and stay healthy, you know, instead of just constantly having to go up and down and get back right and then come back. So, but I think they're just going to play it as safe as they can, and it should help the rest of the team out as they try and figure some things out early in the season. But I'm not as concerned with LeBron in general. Man's a machine.
Mike, where are you at on this?
You know, it's now what? He's been in LA 4 years. This is his fourth season. Three of those seasons now, he's suffered from, you know, various degrees of minor nagging injuries. You know, his first year there, he missed all that time. Last year, he missed all the time with the ankle and missed what he missed. Now you have this. And, you know, who knows how long this is going to linger? I mean, like, I don't know too much about this injury. And the only season that he kind of was this indestructible, like, never get hurt guy, there was a 3-month break because of a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to the degree to which, like, this sort of thing is catching up to James, I would argue it has already caught up. And that's just the reality of, like, machines break down eventually. Like, that's just how life works. You know, and I think you just hope. I mean, I often think of the parallels between this Lakers team and that last, like, Kobe Nash, Kobe Bryant team, where you had sort of similar, like, collection of star talent that couldn't hold up. And that season, Kobe just kept playing until one day that Achilles just snapped, and that was really it for him. And so I think Steve's right, a cautious approach to LeBron. You don't want that to happen to him, because you know that they kind of need, I still think they kind of need him to be at that level. But, you know, if they really want to be as good as they can be, but, like, he can't, they need to be preemptive about this to avoid a Kobe situation, I think. So I don't know. I mean, I think in terms of wear and tear, like, yeah, I think it has caught up to him. And I don't know. We're afraid to say that because I think LeBron has proven us wrong a lot. But, I mean, I don't know. It's just, I don't think it's, like, the worst thing in the world to say that, yeah, a guy who's played that many minutes and is this age, like, yeah, his body doesn't hold up as easily. That's how aging works.
Like, to your point, like, this is something, if LeBron was even close to a normal basketball player, this is the kind of thing that would have happened a very long time ago. Like, the fact that this last, like, 3 or so year stretch that he's had the nagging injuries, the fact that it just kind of started with him speaks to how well he's taken care of his body. In some cases, just how lucky he's been, and also just generally how good he is. So, and I'm with Steve, like, this does present a unique opportunity for, like, Russell Westbrook in particular to continue to find the rhythm with this offense, continue to build chemistry with Anthony Davis and pick and roll in particular. Just get those two guys used to playing without LeBron. Because even when LeBron's healthy, like, you would imagine there are going to be, like, some Russ and AD lineups while LeBron gets some rest on the bench. So, like, just getting those kind of reps, I think, is a silver lining to all of this. Again, the report was LeBron's going to be out at least a week. So it may just be a week. It may be two, depending on how he's feeling, or, you know, the rigors of the schedule, or someone else is out or whatever. So we'll just have to track that and see.
But I'll take the over.
That may very well be the case, but I do think the Lakers can take some good out of this if they are just being precautionary with LeBron and kind of trying to manage him throughout this 82-game marathon. Then it's good to get reps with your other guys, preserve LeBron a little bit, and make sure that he's fresher for the playoff run. I mean, it's early to talk about that now, but we all know what the Lakers' primary goals are. So I'm not in panic mode, but it does seem like this is like the age and the general mileage LeBron has put on throughout his career. Like, it's finally starting to really hit him at this point. And with that, let's move on to the Washington Wizards, who are 5-3 right now. 15th in offense. They are 13th in defense. I will start with you, Mike. What has surprised you the most about this Wizards team this year?
Not much. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, that sounds like really conceited and like kind of, oh, I told you so, but they're a pretty good team with a lot of pretty good players. I think defensively they've been better than I expected, although they were kind of rough against Toronto the other night, at least in the first half. You know, I thought I wasn't like you. I know you were very skeptical that they would be a good defensive team. I didn't think they would be a terrible defensive team because, you know, Wes Unseld is a good defensive coach. I thought they could use like a more aggressive approach with their personnel. But I think they've even been a little better than I expected. Certainly ball containment wise, defensive rebounding has been better than I thought. I thought they would get crushed there. They're allowing like the right types of shots, which is interesting considering that generally they're playing a more aggressive style, but like they're not allowing a lot of threes. They're not allowing a ton of shots at the rim. They're allowing a lot of mid-range shots. Teams are shooting, getting a little lucky on them as far as the three-point percentage they're hitting. So, I mean, that might turn around. But they've been more solid defensively than I thought. But, you know, otherwise, I mean, between that and then the only other real surprise is that Bradley Beal did not start the season particularly well, and that's a negative surprise. But, you know, other than that, you know, I think that it's just such a different team with such a different coach and such a different collection of players. I think people underestimated the degree to which, you know, it helps in the regular season to have a bunch of guys who are decent, who are pretty good, you know. And last year they had the complete opposite team, super top heavy and not a lot of depth. And this year, you know, guys like Dinwiddie, Kuzma, Harrell, Danny Avdia is playing really well. You know, I'll tell you who could use some of those guys that I just named, the Los Angeles Lakers. You know, they'd be nice to have.
That's so fire.
Yeah. You know, I'm sorry. I just think that trade was just like so silly. I mean, I think the Wizards made out like bandits. I thought at the time, and I thought it even more now. So, you know, I'm not terribly surprised, honestly, by a lot of what I'm seeing. It's just maybe it's been a little bit better than I expected win-loss wise. And maybe, but no, I mean, they're playing exactly how I thought they would play with this personnel.
I was actually going to ask you this question. You brought it up a little bit because as I was watching them in the preseason, I was like, there's something about the Wizards. And I wanted to see how you felt about the contrast of the Wizards actually having like lineups they can play and like able to space the floor and be able to have multiple guys who can dribble and make plays and you can actually go draw and kick and have a defense where you can actually, you know, do multiple things. Kuzma might be able to switch. Harrell might be in a drop. Gafford's pretty good. How does it feel to actually watch just like solid basketball?
Oh my God, man. You have no idea. I mean, I sound like such a spoiled person, like I'm in the desert, but I have to be honest, like as a fan, someone who's like watched them for many, many years, like not someone, like someone who's, I think maybe missed three games in a decade total. Last year sucked as a fan. I didn't enjoy it. You know, the Russell Westbrook show, it was all about him. And like, that's sort of how Scott Brooks coached the team. That's how Russ kind of played. I mean, that's kind of how Russ always plays. But so much of it was about like kind of what is Russ doing and is Russ getting his triple double and is Russ willing them to the victory? You know, it just felt like so many of the other players were lost in that setup. I mean, I think you look at Denny Avdia in particular. I mean, he was just lost playing with Russell Westbrook. And this year he's actually allowed to play his game. And, you know, whether it was effective or ineffective or however it worked out, it was just such a roller coaster that it was honestly unenjoyable. It didn't feel, it felt so inorganic. You know, it felt like the Michael Jordan years, where from a national perspective, like, oh my God, it's so cool. Michael Jordan is here and Michael Jordan is doing his thing. But like locally, like the team was literally a Michael Jordan team. It was Michael Jordan's handpicked coach doing what Michael Jordan wanted. It was Jordan and all the other guys didn't matter. And that wasn't very fun as a fan of that team. So to just have a team that's like, honestly, like that trade just made them the polar opposite of that, and for better and for worse. You know, they don't have that guy that's going to just thrust them to wins when their energy isn't there. They don't have that focal point, that guy that can sort of take over a game. But they just have so many guys that it's a real team now. It's a team that has a structure. It's a team with a coach that's coaching all 15 guys. You know, instead of sort of coaching Russ and everybody else has to fall in line with Russ. And yeah, I'm thinking a playoff series, you know, that's not going to be super helpful. But for right now, I think it's just nice to see a platform that like kind of makes sense for everyone. You know, they have really good role players. They have guys who do things spacing wise, rotation wise, defensively, that are like hard to measure, but like appreciated. And they've traded off, like, you know, some, I think their shot creation is a little bit shaky sometimes, even though it looks nice, you know, it can bog down really well. But I just, the trade-off is just such a breath of fresh air. You know, it's been a while since I think the Wizards have had a team like that. So I think for a lot of fans, it really like had to watch every Russ game instead of just sort of observing it from afar. It's just so much more fun. It looks like it makes so much more sense. Whether they're better or worse, like probably about the same ultimately, but it just looks better.
Makes sense. Speaking of looking better, Spencer Dinwiddie's been off to a really good start. I was going to ask you, how have you felt about the Dinwiddie Beal pairing early? Has it looked better than you thought? Or were you surprised by Dinwiddie maybe being at this level this early coming back? Where were you at with that?
Yeah, I think he was really good early in the season. The last couple of games, I feel like he's looked a little tentative and hasn't looked like himself. I don't think he had a really good game against Toronto. So I think that explains a little bit why they've lost the last two games. Hasn't been that level of player that he was a week ago. I think what's interesting is, you know, there are two guys. I think part of the appeal of pairing them together is that Dinwiddie is very effective player without another ball handler, but he can also sort of fit in with another ball handler. And they played a lot of time apart. There's been a lot of Raul Neto. It's been weirdly engrossing and fun. And a lot of Aaron Holiday, which has been kind of interesting. So I thought that when they got Dinwiddie, that was sort of one of the appeals, is that now you can actually like join a bench together and you have a guy that can actually lead a bench unit. Like theoretically, Russ could too. But again, it just has to go Russ's way. Like Dinwiddie does it in a more subtle way. You can pair him with more different types of players. He'll defend his position. And I think early in the season, he's started off really well. He had that big game against the Pacers. Recently, I think he's been a little more tentative. But I think it kind of works in a weird way. Like they don't really fit together, but they don't really have to. It's kind of an interesting dynamic. I do worry a little bit that like as great as they are playing separately, like they do need to fit a little bit better together. There are still times where they're kind of taking turns, you know, running pick and roll, where if Beal is doing his thing, Dinwiddie seems invisible. And if Dinwiddie's getting downhill, running pick and roll with Gafford or Harrell, like Beal's not really there. They've got to figure that out eventually. Dinwiddie is like one of those interesting players who's never really had this opportunity, has played a lot with bench units. He can kind of sometimes take over and sometimes not. He's sort of an interesting piece there. I think he's a better shooter than his percentage shows because he takes a lot of tough shots. I think he's kind of a really, at a macro level, he's a really good fit. And then kind of in a micro level, I think it's a little shaky. Kind of an interesting sort of player.
And to that point, just to throw a quick number out there, per PBP stats, the Beal and Dinwiddie pairing has played 119 minutes together. The Wizards have a 97.9 offensive rating in those minutes. Though the defense is also really good. Like it's slight negative.
Not what you'd expect, right? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like without Raul Neto, I mean, I don't know where this team would be. That dude's been on fire to start the year. But I mean, that's also part of the appeal, though, is like maybe the pairing doesn't work well together, but like now you can actually stretch out individual lineups without them. And you have like, you can kind of maintain a rotation more throughout the course of the game. But it's interesting. I think Dinwiddie's kind of the type of player that is not what people think he is until you sort of watch him up close.
So is it with that pairing in particular, does that just kind of come down to, like with Dinwiddie having the ball in particular, does it just kind of come down to Bradley Beal starting to knock down shots since he has been so cold to start the year?
I think it's a part of it, for sure. I think, yeah, for all the Wizards are a really good illustration. I don't know, Steve, what you think of this as a coach. It seems like there's such a razor thin line between stagnation and like whiplash ball movement, right? For an offense. Like you're either moving the ball so well that it's like, man, look how well they're sharing the ball, or it's like, God, that nobody's passing them. Like there's some such a weird, like kind of interesting razor thin margin. I think the reason is because all of that whiplash ball movement depends on you making that first advantage, you know, breaking down that first play, and all this sort of multiple playmakers thing. Like if that first domino does not fall, then no domino falls. And I think what's happening with Beal and Dinwiddie a lot is that they are each good at starting the first domino falling, but like they don't help the other one necessarily tumble the first domino. And so I think what happens a lot, and you've seen this a lot, I think when they play teams that switch on them, it just sort of stagnates and peters out because nobody's actually kind of creating an advantage. And all the other guys are sort of just waiting for that sort of cacophony of ball movement to happen. And I think that's sort of why you have a rough offensive team. Like it's all kind of starting the same way, pick and roll, trying to get downhill. Like the guards got to make a play. There's a lot on them. And if they're doing well, then everybody else kind of starts to feel like, okay, now Kuzma is able to play off them and kind of hit movement threes and catch the ball and go. And KCP's hitting threes and Harrell's kind of doing his thing inside and Gafford's catching lobs and Avdija's catching the ball on the move and attacking. But it all kind of depends on that first person doing something. And, you know, Beal and Dinwiddie, I don't think yet enhance each other's ability to knock that first domino down. And so I think that's what they need to continue to work on. You know, I think Dinwiddie is a effective mover off the ball, but he's not a great like spot up shooter. He's, I think, not a great like kind of catch and drive person. He gets a little tentative. And Beal, I think, you know, is fighting a lot of the times this like kind of last 3 years, he's been able to kind of dribble as much as he wants and make as many plays as he wants. And now he's kind of got to sometimes be that and then sometimes blend in. I think they're still working that out.
I think they're definitely working the kinks out. I think they do have some good movement stuff, but I think, I don't know if maybe it's the rule changes, Beal not being able to get as loose at times. But as you mentioned, the one thing about the Wizards is their execution has looked better at times, their spacing has looked better, but also when it goes south pretty quick. So if the defense defends that first action, it's now what? So now that flow starts to slow down. Maybe it's ISO, maybe it's catch and hold, whatever it is. I think to your point, there's a lot of times where maybe Beal's in a pick and roll, the ball swings, the defense recovers, it swings to Dinwiddie, now it's a pause, and now what do we do now? And so it's just kind of getting that rhythm between them where, okay, now we flow into another pick and roll, or I drive an attack and just kind of keep the flow going for this Wizards team. I think it's, they like you said, they complement each other because there are times where I think because Bradley Beal is so good off the ball, that you can use him and move him. And you know, if the ball moves or Dinwiddie's catching it, now he can cut and come off a screen, that kind of thing. I don't think the Wizards have gotten there yet, but it's been better than I anticipated.
Yeah. I think part of it too is that they don't really have their other next best passer is like Avdija. I think that's interesting. When Avdija is in the game, it feels like things move a little bit better, even though he's not a great offensive player. It's like things flow. Kuzma, KCP, those guys are really good at attacking and scoring for themselves off movement, but not for creating for others, I think. I think that's part of it. And Rui Hachimura is sort of the same way whenever he comes back. And Gafford and Harrell, Gafford is a catch-lob guy. You know, if you throw the ball to him in the short roll, he's still mechanical there. Harrell is better. He's really improved there, but and so that's why their offense is better, but he doesn't offer the lob threat. So yeah, I think there's a whole lot of that too. It's sort of like the comparison I think about a lot is for a long time, Utah seemed to be caught in this like kind of either they're in the blender or they're stagnant. Mm-hmm. And it took, I think, maybe slowly acquiring guys like Conley, Ingles, Royce O'Neal becoming a slightly better passer with his, some of the other guys, even Bogdanovich, really. Some of the other guys where it's like now you've got to surround the initial guy who creates the play with guys who can kind of make quick passing reads. Yeah, because Gobert is a rim roller, not, you know, a short roller, although he's gotten better at it. And so the line is thin until you develop those secondary playmakers. And that's, I think, where the Wizards are a little short. And that's just the nature of the roster. Hard to figure out exactly where they tease some of that stuff out.
Makes sense. You've already kind of touched on your feelings on the Rush trade. Like, how have you felt about the play of Harrell, the play of Kuzma, the play of KCP? Or I'll kick it off like this. Like, how would you rank those three players in terms of impact so far this year?
I think Harrell's clearly made the most impact. I mean, he seems to be back to the role that makes sense for him, which is like this regular season, four out, and I'm rushing the rim destroyer type. Mm-hmm. I think offensively his stats have been a little shaky, but I mean, I think he's kind of been the unsung hero of this team so far. You know, his ability to guard multiple positions, his help defense, his ability to keep the ball moving. You know, I think his rebounding is kind of out of this world right now, which is like kind of stunning. And then you have KCP, who I think has been very solid, but just isn't playing as much as those other two. But yeah, I mean, honestly, the trade's been better than I thought. Like, those guys I thought would be productive, useful players. And I've kind of always thought that Kuzma had much more grit to him that would show once he left the glitz of LA and he stopped being like the Lakers savior man. But, you know, I think they've all played a lot better, I mean, than I thought they would. I mean, I don't know where they'd be without those guys, considering that, I mean, Beal has been struggling. And Dinwiddie, after a fast start, has really not looked quite like himself since the last couple of games. So, I mean, hallelujah for those guys, honestly.
Well, it's interesting because those are the three guys that actually kind of got me excited about Washington just because of their ability to play solid, but their ability to fit right in. You know, KCP's a guy who can guard some top guys or multiple positions, guard wing-wise if you need it. Kuzma can switch multiple positions, like you said, and also give you some offensive pop in different ways. Play him in different positions. Now you've got Harrell back in the role, as you stated, that he's probably more fit to. These guys are having a little bit more opportunity to be themselves while also maintaining some of what made them good in LA. I guess not for Montrez. He just washed all that away. But
yeah.
Have you liked Harrell's defense? I'm curious on your take on that.
It has been better than I expected. Until the Toronto game, when I thought it was pretty bad. I mean, clearly he's limited. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, they had him in a drop for a lot of that game. Bizarre to me. I mean, Fred VanVleet just kept popping jumpers on them. But if he's playing a more aggressive style, which they have generally done this year, you know, yeah, I mean, he's limited, but you can work with that, I think. It didn't work with how LA wanted to defend. And I'm not sure it's going to work in the playoffs against like real centers, but I do think that like some of the defensive limitations that he's had are sort of situational rather than embedded. I mean, he was terrible against Nikola Jokic, but like that's like the worst possible matchup for him. Like back in the 2020, you know, if you have him like coming up to the level of the ball and like you have a little bit more length behind him, like he can do that, and he has been doing that. I think honestly, like right now, he's just playing too many minutes. You know, Gafford was hurt for a couple games, and Harrell's been just shouldering such a heavy load, and Thomas Bryant is still hurt, and Hachimura's not back, so you don't really have any small ball options. You know, I think if they can tamper his roll down, he'll play better defense.
No, I think, yeah, Harrell is definitely a scheme guy who can execute against specific talent. He's really good in a drop against non-shooters. I guess really good is probably too much, but he's solid in a drop against non-shooters. And if he gets to the level consistently against shooters, he's good. The in-between, you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
But Daniel Gafford's defense, I have enjoyed. I think he's making steps as far as the health defense protection. He's just continued to be solid. I've liked watching him play. What have you thought about Gafford?
So that's some ways to go for sure. I mean, I think the thing you like is from a coaching perspective is that he's active and there's just still so much more room that he can be better. You know, I think that's what you like about him. I think clearly he's still not the best in space. I think he still is going for too many things. He still does foul a lot, but there is this like kind of capacity to learn and capacity to try to improve that is exciting. I think from a coaching standpoint, but you know, I think he's going to get exposed in some matchups down the road. Still, he's still a little jumpy. And I mean, it's interesting. The thing I really want to see Gafford improve actually is that, and I think the Wizards have played a lot of teams that have switched on them or trapped them. You know, they played the Celtics twice, they played Toronto twice. I mean, these are teams that are probably lean more towards the aggressive side. So he's had a lot of opportunities to kind of make plays in short roles, and he needs to get better there because he's such a great lob threat. If he can just catch the ball at the free throw line and make the next pass, like that will just take away the one strategy that teams will just use against the Wizards over and over until he can prove to do it. And I think he's, again, there's like a capacity to learn there where it's like he's still not there, but you can sense that he's like kind of getting closer slowly but surely, and that's exciting.
He's one of my favorite young bigs in the league. Like, I think for Gafford, it's not Montrez level for me, but like watching him in a drop still feels like a little bit of an adventure. Like he's still trying to mm-hmm. find that balance between, you know, throwing the ball handler, getting back to the role, man. Just that in between area is just kind of weird for him. And I think that kind of aids in the jumpiness because I think he recognizes in real time that he may be a step up too far or a step too far back. And so he's trying to balance that. That gets him up in the air. That opens up some lobs if he lunges out. And if not, if a ball handler's patient enough, they get him up in the air and does those easy fouls and stuff. So I do love, and we talked about this on the podcast throughout last year, especially when Washington made their run late year. Like, I love just the level of aggression and the level of violence that he plays with on both ends. Like, when he is locked into that drop and he finds that sweet spot, you can't really do anything with him at the rim. He will spike the ball at you. And on the other end, like, he's such a violent role, man. Like, if you don't throw a tag at him, like, he's getting up there. The catch radius is wild. You're not getting in front of him. So, like, if he can just – as the game slows down for him, like, I think he's going to be much better on both ends. Like, I'm pretty excited for him.
It's an interesting challenge, I think, that he faces because he came into the league as, like, a very specific type of player playing a very specific role. I mean, that's what he's done really his entire life, and now the book is starting to get out on that, you know, over the last couple of years, you know, particularly with they're trapping his screens really fast so that he's got to catch the ball in space. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that like teams started to do to Andre Drummond years ago. I mean, it took him so long, and really only now is he starting to get there to where he could catch the ball at the free throw line and know what to do next. You know, what do I do when you're not throwing a lob at me? He's at that stage. You know, Larry Sanders was there at one point. Like it feels like a rite of passage for players of this type. And it's just interesting. He's now at that stage where he's got to sort of maintain the aggression that made him, but be smarter about it. And that's a stage that some players never get past and some players do. And they just blossom. You know, it's an interesting moment of development. And that's why I felt really terrible for him that he got hurt and missed those couple of games. And I'm so thankful that it wasn't worse because I think he needs that court time.
Yeah, John Collins is another guy. Like over the last year or so, he's gotten much better at making those short roll reads. Another thing that we've talked about on the podcast, just trusting him more in space to make not just the right decision, but to make that decision in time because there's a lot of record scratching with him. And I think in those short roll opportunities, it's more so about the decisiveness than anything. But even if you make absolutely, the right read, yeah. if you take an extra dribble to try to make that pass to the corner where you take wherever you're taking it, the defense recovers, you're right back to square one. You have to try to create that advantage all over again. So, with the reps, like, I think he's going to get there. And if he gets there, does that further complicate the center room when everyone's healthy? Because it's Gafford, Harold, Thomas Bryant comes back at some point, or like it's just, does that really just establish who the top dogs are at that point?
I see it as something that just will have to work itself out. Like, we don't even know if Thomas Bryant is going to look like after surgery. I mean, I feel like he probably feels like, oh man, this sucks. Like, by the backup's playing so well, and you know what he is. I mean, and it might be a problem at the end of the year, but I do think that there is some element of, like, they do offer something a little bit different. Like, Brian is probably the best offensive skilled player of the three of them.
Mm-hmm.
He can run dribble handoff better than the other two. I mean, Harold's gotten better at it. He's a better passer. He can step back and run pick and pop. He can't really do that with those other two guys. So there is, like, a role for him. I don't know what he's going to look like. I just got to let it see it play out. And, you know, again, maybe Gafford just never gets past that sort of stage of, like, can I be a consistent 30-minute guy, a game guy, without losing concentration and fouling all the time? You know, maybe he just never gets to that stage. The nice thing is, you know, they're both on, at least Gafford and Brian are both on pretty good contracts, you know, relatively affordable. I guess they're both, like, what, like about $13 million a year? We could always trade one. I just said let that situation play itself out.
Okay. One more thing on the Wizards before we move on to the mailbag segment. We haven't seen Rui Hachimura yet. When he does come back, what area of his game are you most excited to see? Or what area of improvement do you want to see for him?
I really don't know, man. Like, first of all, nobody really knows what's going on with him. He's clear something that's happening. It also kind of feels like it's the type of thing that's almost good that we don't know. Unless it's, you know, like, I don't know. It seems like something that they're trying not to tell people and respect his distance. I don't know. It's hard to know. As far as where he fits in, you know, I think he's one of the things I've always thought about him is that, like, he's got, like, sort of the game, but I need him to get a better body almost. Like, I feel like he's not cut up enough. He's not, like, sharp cutting enough. It feels like it takes him too long to get to where he wants to go. You know, there was a big focus on a 3-point shot. I think he got a little bit better there last year. But it still feels like, you know, every move he makes, every sort of decision he makes, it's kind of like Gafford. You know, it just takes time, a beat too long. And if you take a beat too long in this system, you know, last year it was much more of a stationary, like, he's the third guy that we throw a bone to. And, you know, he's mostly standing and Russ is sort of creating everything for him and then spoon feeding. This year, I think it is going to require him to do a lot more to kind of find his spot. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't think he should start now. I don't think you should take Kuzma out of the starting lineup. You know, Avdija is playing so well. I think you need to keep him's minutes where they are. I guess Bertans is injured now, so that's helpful. But, like, I just want to see, like, if he really is this quick decision maker that can make plays quickly, like, he needs to show it. And I think part of the reason he hasn't shown it is that I don't think he's, like, in – he needs to. I want to see, like, Kuzma looks more cut up this year than I can remember, for example. I'd love to see Rui come back and look like that version of Kuzma. I mean, it feels like Kuzma's just much skinnier, much more cut up, much leaner than I remember. Maybe it's just the jersey.
It might just be the jersey.
I'm not an expert on bodies.
Steve, where are you at on Rui?
I want to see what the next step is for him. And if he's going to be able to consistently bring something to the table. I think there's a lot of things that he can do night in and night out. But I'm always looking for what's the one thing that I know I'm going to get from him. You know, is it going to be defense? Is it going to be improved playmaking? Is it going to be a jack of all trades? But I kind of just want to see if he takes another step in the right direction. He's built, I feel like, more he's played, he's gotten more comfortable. The jump shot going to be there. He's going to be a driver. He's going to be a roller. I just want to see it all come together a little bit more.
Okay, I got you. It's watching Rui last year, it was odd for me. Like, I felt he was further along defensively than I thought he would be at this stage, and also a little further behind offensively than I thought. Like, I agree with Mike. Like, it did feel like there was some record scratching with him. Like, the jumper kind of is what it is. But, like, if you're not going to have the jumper that the team or the fans want you to have, at the very least, be decisive, be aggressive. And there were, like, spurts of that. Particularly when he was playing the four, to where you could see where he could be a bit of an issue for defenses, like too quick for bigger fours, too big for the smaller ones. If you had just a traditional wing on him, he could kind of put his head down and get to the rim. He's just trying to find his space. And I think this is going to be more of a challenge. Like, he's away right now. We don't know what it is. And now he's going to be in yet another system. And not just another system, but an entirely different system than what he played with last year. So I want to see what that process is going to be like integrating him. But I think this is going to be a pretty big year for him because, I mean, Washington does have some wings in the pipeline. Now, again, Kuzma's been playing well. His year two of Ivy, if he stays healthy, like, I do like him as kind of a connector piece. And you may need more of that connector piece alongside, like, the Bill Dinwiddie pairing. So I want to see how Rui's able to fit in.
Yeah, I think it's striking that Avdija looks so much better in this system. Whereas, and I mean, we haven't seen Rui. Like, maybe he'll surprise me. But, like, I was a little worried about Rui even before all this stuff happened. Like, how would he fit into the style? Whereas last year, Avdija looked like he was like, "Come on, let me do something, man. Like, I'm just standing here in the corner. Like, can't you let me do something?" And now he has a system that lets him do things. And he just feels like he's blossoming. And Rui is now, I think, was better in the structure and the sort of beat, beat, beat of last year. And this year, where it's like more of a flow, I just wonder for him. It's just interesting. I think they are such opposite players. Kind of fascinating.
It'll be interesting to see. All right. Let's move on to our mailbag segment. If you have mailbag questions for us, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com moving forward. So do that. Thank you for all the great questions that we received for this episode. Keep them coming, please. The first one comes from Aaron, who asked, what tools or websites do you use to watch film? Steve, what do you use to watch film?
TV and a computer.
Yeah. I was going to say, does NBA League Pass? That's what I use.
There you go.
It's interesting. The premise of the question is interesting, as if like there's some secret like sort of film video. I mean, I know NBA teams have, you know, like Synergy and all this other stuff that they can cut up. But like, this is what's sort of beautiful about like the work that I think you guys do and we do is like everyone can see what's happening. We're using the same screen you are. We're watching the same 10 players you are. And, you know, there's just, it's an illustration of how much is going on in the course of a play. Like, that's why I've always like sort of believed in this sort of coverage is that no one person can possibly see everything. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's all the same tools. Like I don't think there's some like sort of secret. The tools aren't what you notice. It's the way the tools and the players interact with each other. You sort of see different things with the same screen. This is, to me, that's like kind of the beauty of this work and why it sucks sometimes that people are, you know, so dense with it instead of just kind of treating it that way. Like, there is no special tool. I don't know. I mean, maybe Steve thinks differently, but like, I don't know. I'm just, it's all the same material. There's nothing special about the film we watch. It's not like doctored with like special, super high HD, like sort of pop things that pop, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you on there. Like, the film itself isn't special. Like, I guess to answer the question is straightforward. Like, it's a mixture of League Pass and like, we do have an Instat subscription at the site. So I am able to watch games without dead balls, or if I want to specifically watch, like, it really depends on what I'm doing. Like, if I just want to watch a game on Instat, I want to get the dead balls out of the way so I can get through the game quicker. And if I'm working on a piece or I want to hone in on a specific player, then they do have sections for me to look at, like a player's drives from a particular game or a player's assist opportunities, or like if I want to look at pick and roll positions. So I can divvy it up that way. So I don't know if that helps Aaron in this case, but that's kind of, it depends on what I'm trying to do, honestly.
The hashtag is big time, folks.
That's not big time at all. I mean, Instat and Synergy are kind of under the same umbrella where you can kind of cut up possessions that way. So again, like if I'm actually working on something, then I'm looking at those specific like play types. And if not, then I'm just watching the games with Instat or League Pass. League Pass for live, Instat for catching up.
And all the clips are available on NBA.com too.
Yeah.
So there's also that, you know. But yeah, I mean, this is sort of like an interesting epistemological, it's late at night. Like, I never watch parts of games. I only watch start to finish in order. Like, I'm like militaristic about that. I assume you guys are a little bit different. Like, you're more willing to pick up in the middle of a game and watch like half a game or watch two games at once or something. But like, to me, like, that's just, I never do that. Is that like, am I wrong?
No, there's no wrong way to watch.
No, I mean, am I wrong that that's not what you do?
Oh, it depends on the timing. Depends on what I want to watch. So like, if there was a blowout, I might watch the first half of a game.
Right. Yeah, I guess
skip the rest. Yeah. Or like, if maybe it was a tight game, I want to see, you know, I might say Boston comes back from down 15. I might just want to watch that part. But for me, ideally, I would love to watch every game from start to finish so I can have the full context. And the problem is sometimes I get stuck. So I'll just start watching a game and I can't stop till I finish it.
Mm.
Which leads me to like watch entirely too much like Kings and Pistons.
That's is it too much?
Never too much.
Minnesota Timberwolves?
Dude, that's more my speed.
Yeah.
We're trying to get Steve on.
You haven't talked about him in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I'll put it this way. I'd rather watch a game later if I can watch it start to finish than watch it live.
No, I agree with you. There's
yeah, games. But I mean, like I will like purposely start a 7 o'clock game at 8 o'clock.
Oh yeah, to avoid the no, that makes sense. That way you can just keep going. That makes sense.
Yeah.
There's certain games that I will stop watching live so I can rewatch it.
Like, but then you're not rewatching.
It's too late for logic.
See, I guess
I will stop watching a game live so I can watch it the next day and pause and fast forward for over 2 hours.
See, like, I probably need to get to that point. Why? For me, like,
whatever,
I'm
whatever it works for you. Who says you have to do it our way?
Well, that's true. But
be yourself, man. It's gotten you this far.
You're Mr. AVO.
Oh God, the bit continue. But no, like I think just in terms of like time consumption, I probably need to do that. But like I'm very much online, which the people enjoy, I guess. So I'll try to catch up on the game if I can. If I'm behind, I'll start the game wherever, and then catch up during like timeouts or something, which is very unorganized, honestly. But like it works for me in a weird way.
Look, if it works for you, that's all that matters. But I mean, I only ask these questions because, like, this question of like what tools do you use to watch film? I think just to illustrate to people that there's not really like a magic to it. We're all seeing the same stuff you are. It's just we're frankly paying closer attention to it. That's really all it is.
That's fair. All right, let's move on to our next question from PD Webb, who asks, what have been the trendy play calls or actions of the early season?
I'm deferring to y'all on this because I think this framing is over. The framing of play calls and actions is overrated.
Ooh, I mean, get into that. Why do you think it's overrated?
I just think the game is a flowing game, especially now. Like when you sort of reduce it to like it's this action versus six action, it feels too stilted, and you know, it's not most of the time a play succeeds or fails because of how well it's run, not because of how it's designed. I don't know, maybe Steve disagrees. So I just think it just sort of, we can get a little carried away with like, oh wow, that play looks cool, but it's really all about how it works.
I slightly disagree because there's some really creative stuff design wise that can put a lot of pressure on defenses, but the actions don't necessarily make everything pop because you can have run a great play and not score and then just ISO for 18 possessions and score and win a game. So I went kind of big picture with my answer. So for me, it's been a lot more flow, as Mike said. So there's been a lot more teams just kind of playing randomly, in my opinion. I think obviously continue with a lot of empty side pick and rolls, a lot of empty corner pick and rolls with a spacer on the wing. A lot of pistol, a lot of dribble handoffs, hitting the big, playing out of it. I feel like every team runs elbow action. One thing I've noticed is there's more movement before pick and rolls or handoffs. So they'll like set a fake screen and then try and move the defense and then go to their action instead of completely just standing out right in the front in the middle of the floor and just letting it ride. A lot of double pick and roll from a lot of teams, a lot of double drags and transition. The one thing I noticed was mismatch hunting. There's more teams kind of using cross matches
and setting screens in transition to kind of attack that mismatch early before the defense can load up.
The Warriors' legacy.
It continues. And then I'm seeing more teams, they'll have the guy they want to get the ball or get the mismatch set the screen rather than have him start with the ball.
Yeah. Yeah, there's sort of like a little bit more. I think this is not necessarily a thing. This is like a last 5 years thing. It's a lot more like we're attacking like with like a slight head start, whether it's like that or whether it's you see this like the boomerang action is like the popular thing now where you'll force a switch against the big, the guard will give it up and then like back up and catch it. So he's sort of in a running start, the old Victor Oladipo special. I'm seeing a lot of that. I have to, you know, let me ask you guys this. Does it feel like it feels like to me that defenses are more aggressive than they have been schematically in the past. I think there's
way more variety.
I think we're seeing less like sort of straight drops. And the other thing I think we're seeing is much more, and I noticed this first in the bubble, and I think it's continued. You're seeing teams like come help down. The low man is coming lower, and then they are just spraying out shooters faster. It's like, I think the league has collectively gotten better at closeout. And part of the reason is because they're going down early instead of like kind of being caught off balance so that when they close out, they are only closing in one direction. There's less like ambiguity of like, do I cover the shooter or do I kind of help in the paint? The default now is I'm going to help in the paint and then I'm going to get after the shooter. I don't know. That might be like, might be wrong about that, but it just feels that way.
And also I think part of it is because a lot of teams are looking to get into that drive and kick where we drive and kick out and spray and play out of it. A lot of teams are better than others. But you bring up a good point with the defense. There's been way more variety scheme-wise this year than I've seen. Like, we're seeing bigs actually, like, show out and hedge, which I haven't seen since, like, 2015. And you're seeing, you know, it's less just straight base, like, okay, we're in a drop, and that's that. And you're seeing more teams use different coverages in the same game. I'll use Portland for an example. You can make fun of their defense all you want, but in a game I saw them play drop, show at the level, trap, play zone, switch. And that's a lot from like teams just sticking with their base until they got hurt and then, oh, we got to figure it out.
So I have a crack theory on this. And I think the two things we've talked about are kind of related. Is it that defenses are playing different coverages or is it that the offensive stuff is just flowing so much quicker and the process from going from one pick and roll to another, to all this is just, it is impossible to have a base coverage because the transition is happening so quickly that whether the defense intends to or not, they are just accidentally in a different coverage every time in order to just keep up. Like it's more a reflection of how fast a half court possession moves now compared to 5 years. Does that make sense?
That's an interesting point.
Like, I don't know if it's all intentional. Like they're saying, hey, we're going to trap this pick and roll and we're going to switch this one and we're going to come to level on this one. I just think it all just moves so fast that like...
Oh, no. I just meant during the course of a game. Like they went from doing that to now we're doing this to now we're doing that. So not necessarily on the same possession. That's entirely too difficult. You could never coach that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was hard enough to be like, hey, this is a shooter. You got to defend the pick and roll this way. And this is not a shooter. You got to defend the pick and roll this way. Which is what we kind of used to do in Memphis. But yeah, from possession to possession, they're going to stay in their base.
I see what you're saying.
But as far as in-game adjustments, there's more of that as opposed to we're just going to ride with what we got.
I would say it feels like, for me at least, there's a little bit of that selective coverage in pick and roll. Like I think a traditional like 1-5 pick and roll, you may have a team, if their base is switched, they're going to switch. If it's dropped, they're going to drop. Like double drag in particular, teams do different things against it. And I think that kind of varies from the base. Like sometimes they switch both screens, sometimes they're just switching that second screen. And then you get a more traditional pick and roll and then whatever that base is, it is. So like maybe that's where you have a little bit more of the, I guess, in possession, like versatility, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all is connected to the players are all starting to look the same. Or every position to the degree that they exist are similar size players. So what is a 1-5 pick and roll now anyway? Like, who is the one? Who's the five? Who's the five? Who's the one? And because there's so much fluidity with that, you're going to get also a fluidity of coverage where, you know, players are all just able to do a lot of different things. So it's just, you know, I mean, like, you guys have talked about this show, and I think you're seeing a lot more. Like, I think almost like the era of the base coverage is like then general, you know. I don't know. Maybe that's a little too extreme.
No, it's a good thing. I'm glad defenses are actually doing different things this year, because it got way too base across the whole league.
Yeah.
You know, you're seeing more personnel based stuff. You're seeing a lot more teams consistently going under on Russell Westbrook, just for an example, or consistently being up against Damian Lillard, or adjusting if CJ McCollum goes off or something like that. Like, that part is fun to me, to see the return of that, because that's how defense kind of used to be. And then drop was really effective, and everyone was like, hey, let's go ahead and just do that. And, you know, then zone kind of mixed in and the bubble. And so it's nice to see just different things happening.
Multiple is the new base.
I think defense in general is making a comeback. Like defensive quality. I think for a few years, I mean, everybody's talking about offense being down this year and like blaming the fouls. I think the simpler explanation is that defense is getting better. I really do. And I think the reason it was mass the last couple of years because shooting was so good.
Mm-hmm.
I just think in general, like, defenders are better at defending in this era. But now I'm encroaching too much on book territory, so I should probably stop.
We're going to give you some time to promote the book towards the end of the pod. Next question comes from Lazarus, who asked, what's the most surprising so far this year? Toronto at 6-3, sans Pascal Siakam for all of them and Scottie Barnes for last two, or the Clippers at 3-5, including a comeback win over the Thunder?
I don't know, neither. I guess the Clippers is a little more surprising to me. I mean, it's just so early in the season. I mean, the Clippers just like haven't shot straight. You know, they were the best shooting team in the league last year, and they can't shoot the ball this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like kind of, there's a lot of variance involved. And lo and behold, they shot the lights out against Minnesota the other night. I think it's also a reflection of the regular season is just not the playoffs. I think a lot of people looked at what the Clippers did in the playoffs without Kawhi Leonard and was like, oh, they can do that over 82 games. Like, that sort of idiosyncratic style. Like, yeah, they could just replicate that. But it's just a totally different game. It's very hard to replicate that against 29 teams instead of one team. And so I thought some of the optimism around the Clippers as a team was a little bit over the top, because it's not like you could fast forward to the playoffs. But I was high in Toronto to start. I'm not surprised they're starting to find their footing. And I'm also not surprised that, like, as fun as Scottie Barnes is, like, not playing him means you can start more shooting, and that makes your whole system better. You know, so I don't know. I would say maybe the Clippers are a little more surprising to me. I didn't think anyone would have trouble beating the Thunder this year. So maybe that's the surprising part.
I feel that. Like, I would probably go with Toronto being more surprising, just because I just didn't think they would have the half-court offense to win the games. So I knew their defense would keep them in it. I didn't think they'd be able to score. And, like, Scottie Barnes being a high-volume scorer as a rookie is just not something that I anticipated. As someone that picked OG Anunoby to be the most improved player in the league this year, like, I didn't think it would be 22 points a game.
They've had their two best offensive games have been without Scottie Barnes, right? The last two.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not. I don't know. It just feels that way. You know, sometimes, like, I think it's particularly in the regular season, like, you can have guys that are scoring really well individually, but you take them out and you replace them with a different part, and, like, it can breathe everything else, life and everything else, you know. Just having both Trent and Svi Mihailuk in the starting lineup just adds more shooting.
Mm-hmm.
That they just didn't have. And, like, Scottie Barnes is brilliant individually, but, like, he isn't shooting the ball from distance. So, like, one player can look awesome individually, and then just, but there's just sort of this is the beauty of basketball, isn't it?
Yeah, I got you. I just mean, like, team-wise, like, I just didn't think Toronto would be good. Yeah, like, they would have to win with the defense and then pushing in transition. The fact that they've been able to get enough out of their half-court attack this year, and it still isn't great, but the fact they've been able to muster enough to win games and have comeback wins, for that matter. I just didn't see it.
OG Anunoby, man. Guys.
Well, he's absurd.
I will admit that I did not think he had this sort of leap. And you obviously did, so I was wrong about that. I guess we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, we'll see what the sample looks like. Steve, which team has surprised you the most between these
Toronto. I thought that would be fun, but I didn't think they'd actually have this kind of winning early. I mean, it's early, but still, I'd say they're ahead of schedule based on what I thought. Nick Nurse always finds a way to look in the cupboard and make a meal out of leftovers. It was going well.
I respect it. That Bantam guy, that rookie whose first name I can't pronounce, like, that dude's legit. That's a classic example. Like, they just found like a 6'7" point guard who's really quality on both ends, can shoot a little bit, can handle, can defend, just sort of just sitting right there. And they found him because he hit a half court shot in the opener.
Shout out to Lonnie Ben. Let's go.
Lonnie Ben. That's his name. There we go.
Let's move on to John, who is greeting us from Norway. Shout out to our Norway listeners. Very cool.
Listeners in Norway?
We have listeners in Norway.
That's salute amazing. To Norway. Wow.
The dunker spot is global.
Best Norwegian NBA player? Has there been a Norwegian NBA player? I'm going to Google this. Sorry, read the question.
While you do your Googles, John asks, let's say these teams make the playoffs. Rank their chances of winning a playoff round. This is between Memphis, Washington, Charlotte, Chicago, and Toronto.
Well, Mil Palacio is from Norway? I didn't know that. Sorry, go ahead.
That's got to be a passport deal.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
If I was ranking these five, like I would probably say...
Wow.
No, I would say Chicago, Memphis... Oh, man. After Chicago and Memphis, it gets kind of iffy for me. Washington, Charlotte, Toronto.
That's my exact five.
Okay. Because, like, I didn't believe in Toronto's half-court offense in the regular season. I sure don't believe it in the postseason. Like, they're a move away before I get there with them in a playoff setting.
Yeah. And similarly, I don't really believe in Charlotte's defense in a playoff series. Kind of the same way. I'm going to say Memphis number one, just because they played an easier conference and I have no idea what to do with the other four.
Fair enough.
If Dylan Brooks comes back and reintegrates himself and Jackson continues to improve, I mean, the West is there for them. You know? I mean, like, I don't know. I know that they still have some problems, but yeah, other than that, I mean, I guess it is interesting how, like, none of us are saying Chicago.
And, like, I said Chicago.
You said Chicago number one. Okay.
Number one.
Okay.
Good luck with DeMar right now.
DeMar is absolutely cooking right now. Yeah, I had Charlotte one, Memphis too. I think Steve in particular was higher on Memphis than I was heading into the year. Ja has taken a star and a half turn this year, which makes this all fun. I don't know. Like, I wish they had another piece in the half court. Like, that's supposed to be Jaren, hopefully. It's been a shaky year for him right now. I don't want that to be Dylan Brooks again, though I'm sure he wouldn't mind it being Dylan Brooks.
I don't think you're going to have a choice.
Yeah, that's part of the hesitation.
What about your guy? I'm not even going to say it. I'm not going to say it because it's late and I don't want to wake up my kid, but, you know, the one who sounds like a Batman villain.
Don't set him up. Don't throw him off.
It's fine. Nikias, it's fine. We've had a great pod. I'm just going to sit back and stay in my lane.
Oh, there it is.
Okay.
I won't talk about Desmond Money.
Now look what you did. This question comes from Jeff, who asks, what player am I not watching but absolutely should be, and why?
What does he want to watch?
I imagine it's just a good player that doesn't get enough recognition. That's the way I took it anyway.
Mm. Add DeJounte Murray down.
That's a good call.
18-8-7, playing great defense.
Would love to see him fire away with confidence with 3-point land. Cause I think he can make them, but like, he seems weirdly reluctant. Like, imagine if he shot, how many threes a game is he shooting right now?
Not many.
Like, imagine if
my uniform guesses one.
Let's see. Da, 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 da. He is taking... No way, that can't be right. 4.3 threes a game? Holy shit.
That's get him like, up.
Wow. Well, like, what if that... Okay, well, that my entire point has been slightly invalidated. But, like, what if he took 7 threes a game? I mean, he's. I think he has the form. Like, I don't know. I think that would get him to another level. But he's a lot of fun to watch. That's a good... That's a good one. Boy. Who should one be watching that they're not watching? I don't know, man. That's a good one. I mean, I guess I'm just trying to figure out like who's like the most random small market kind of player. I guess everybody watches Charlotte now, so like we can't really say any of their players. Jared Allen. I enjoyed watching Jared Allen. Like Cleveland's kind of been a fun team to watch this year. I'm a little surprised by how that's been the case. Like again, Dan Devine wrote about it today, but just like sort of their tall ball experiment has been kind of interesting because I don't know what you guys have noticed, but like they're kind of using Jared Allen, Evan Mobley to switch out onto the perimeter, even though you would think that like, oh, they're not good enough in space, but they're giving room and they're just saying like, hey, we know that like this is basically the point of your offense where like the default rim is right here, out here. Like you want to shoot the ball, you know, you want to go one-on-one, like you need to get around this part of the wall. Why don't we just move the wall out here? And I've been waiting for a team to do this for a while to say like, hey, let's take our rim protector who's awesome at protecting the rim. And we play a team that wants to spread them out and go in space. And let's just like put them out there. Like that's clearly the space of the floor that they value above the rim. You know, I've wanted Utah to do this with Gobert for the longest time. Like, hey, what would happen if like you just took every element that made Rudy such a great rim protector and said, okay, now try to shoot a three over him. I just think that would be like kind of an interesting strategy. And Cleveland's kind of doing it. That's interesting.
The answer was Terrence Mann.
Okay, yeah, he's pretty funny.
No, I meant the answer to your Rudy question.
No, I mean, like okay, so, but I was like saying, like, why not just have Rudy guard Kawhi Leonard? Like, stop doing this, like, let's put him on, let's hide him on the weakest guy and let him stay at the rim. Like, no, let's put him on the best guy and just say, okay, you want to go around him? Like, he's big, he's long, he's really hard to get around. Like, it's going to take you a lot of time. You're going to freeze everybody else out. Like, I wanted Rudy to guard Kawhi. I just wanted to see what that would look like. I have a feeling that would work better than people think. I think a lot of guards think that they can take big men off the dribble better than they actually can.
It's an interesting theory that should be tested out. I guess my answer by default is OG Anunoby. Like, one is the most, he's my most improved player pick. Also, like, he's legit figuring some stuff out as a self-creator. So I think that's fine. The defense just is ridiculous still, which is probably the most important, the most impressive part of the season for me when it comes to him, because he's taken on this higher usage and he's still everywhere defensively. If I can nominate a rookie, like, watch Josh Giddey. Like, I understand OKC's bad, but that young man can pass. The floater's good. He's one of the best rookies in the class.
See, this is where I would recommend, like, don't watch the game. Just, like, go to NBA.com and pull up his assist so that he can watch Josh Giddey without having to watch the rest of the Thunder.
So much. You misspelled Davion Mitchell.
I'm sorry. I'm having an off night. There we go.
That's a good shot.
We've done it. We have done it. This one comes from Ryan. He says, rank these wings on who you take now and in the future. Mikal Bridges, Miles Bridges, RJ Barrett, Michael Porter Jr., and OG Anunoby.
Ooh, I think our answers are going to be way too influenced by like the first 9 games of the season for this one, aren't they? Like, this is like kind of calling out for like us to overrate this 9-game sample. It's very, I love the design of this question for that reason, because you've got like 3 guys who are awesome this year and 2 guys who have been disappointing. And it's like, how would you rank them? And it's just like telling us like, oh, put the guys who are starting really well, really high. And look dumb in like 6 months. It's a tough one.
I got one.
Okay.
I'll go from bottom to top for now. Number 5 is Michael Porter Jr.
See, this is what I'm talking about. Like, he's off to a bad start. So
wait, number 4 is Miles Bridges.
Oh, okay. So you're like mixing it up here a little bit.
Number three is OG Anunoby. Number two is RJ Barrett. Number one is Mikal Bridges.
Wow. I thought I was the biggest Mikal Bridges fan on the planet.
I thought I was the biggest Mikal Bridges fan. I don't know. I was still playing. I wouldn't have had a what. For the wings, I would take now. I would probably have OG one. I think I'd go OG, Mikal, MPJ.
I know, I was joking on mine. I had RJ number one.
Oh, no. I'll go RJ and then Miles.
Here come the Knicks fans.
I mean, I would have RJ fifth in this group, so there you go.
Here they come for you.
You're the saving grace, Steve. You're the saving grace. Anyway, no, like, RJ's welcome. Been good. RJ's been good this year. Like, he's...
I'll take all five of them. They seem... They're all great.
There you
Who
go.
Would that... I take now? Like, I'd take any of them. I'd figure it out.
The answer is yes.
I think, in all seriousness, I think, like, OG is starting to get to the top of that list for me. And I've never been, like, his biggest fan, but, like, if he can make plays off the dribble in addition to, like, kind of all the other stuff he does, like, that's really scary. And I still think, I know Porter's off to a rough start, but he's also got the, like, kind of most valuable skill of all guys. So I'm not giving up on him yet. I would still take him pretty high. And I love Mikal. You know, and look, if Miles Bridges keeps hitting every shot, then I guess he's going to be number one. But, you know, I think that will run out at some point.
That kind of has to cool off at a certain point. All right, and we'll end this one with Not Lucky's Burner on Twitter. I cannot imagine whose burner this is. And he says, who's the one player on a non-contender you would move to a contender, and where would you move them?
I would take Austin Reeves and move him to the Warriors. You know, get him off those, like, lottery-bound Lakers.
Sheesh.
Okay, I'm just kidding. But only slightly. I do think the Lakers are going to have trouble. I think the Lakers are going to be worse. I've always thought that. But, yeah, I don't have an answer yet. I'll let Steve go first. I just had that joke answer.
Let's put Thaddeus Young back on the Bulls.
Yeah, I'll take that. That's
good. That would be nice. I would like Kenrich Williams on literally any playoff team.
Oh, man.
This is the... Come on. Why can I bring up Kenrich Williams? What is the issue?
Oh, man.
What's the problem? He's good at basketball, and he's like filling gaps in OKC right now instead of filling gaps on literally any team that can use a four.
I mean, it's just funny, like, kind of... Is he actually, like, good, or does his ability to do, like, kind of normal things on a basketball court just stand out in Oklahoma City? I haven't figured that out yet.
Well, like,
I don't know the answer to that.
Like, he was also doing these things in New Orleans. So, like, there's a sample
also of him being a crap team.
I mean, that's true, but, like, he did, like, tangibly good things
in
New Orleans. So, like, I don't think it's the bar as low, Kenrich, because, like, I don't think he's a star or anything. Like, I just think he's a seventh man that can help a good team.
Yeah, no, you're right. I'd like to see Eric Gordon freed. I don't know exactly where to put him, but I thought last year Phoenix could have really used him, but, like, they obviously did just fine without him. Chicago could use him. You know, teams that just sort of need, like, a little bit of, like, kind of that extra scoring punch. You know, I'd love to see him on a real team. And it's just his contract kind of sucks, but, like, I guess maybe not Memphis, but, you know, Dallas, I think would be an interesting spot for him. Like, it seems like a lot of Toronto would be really interesting.
Philly.
I would say less Philly. Actually, I think Philly's got a lot of guys like him. But, yeah, a team like that, you know, I guess Miami's got Oladipo coming back, so you wouldn't necessarily say him. But Denver could really use some of that. I'd love to see him, like, kind of back on a real team where he could kind of be unleashed in the role that he was playing with Houston when they were good. That him and John Wall, like, I'd love to see John Wall actually playing somewhere.
But both, yeah, I want to see either of those guys on a team that needs rim pressure, which is a lot of them. It would appear. So I love the Phoenix. Wasn't Phoenix the team that Eric Gordon like originally signed the offer sheet with when he was in New Orleans, and then like asked New Orleans, "Hey, please don't match," and they matched it anyway. And then he got hurt very early the next season.
I guess someone didn't know the open secret about Robert Sarver at the time.
That's kind of tough.
That's probably not so nice. It was Phoenix. It was Phoenix. John Wall, like, you look at like some of the things that Boston's struggling with, like that would be an interesting fit.
I think so. Like, I don't know if they need another guard that can get downhill that teams care about. Because like Dennis Schroeder just does it. And then Marcus Smart does it, but I'm not sure if defenses are like super concerned with him pressuring the rim right now.
And it'd also be helpful if they knew how to pass once they got to the rim.
That would also help. John Wall would immediately be the best passer on that roster.
Yeah. I think that would be interesting. So it's just basically any like veteran on the Houston Rockets, like, or the Oklahoma City Thunder. Let's just like give him out. For real though, Thad Young was a good answer. I just feel like there's so many teams that could really use him, and kind of, I mean, San Antonio is not even playing him a lot. It's kind of strange.
Very weird. I forgot the most obvious answer. Let's get Zion to the Knicks.
Oh, oh no, that's too on the nose, even for you, Mike. Tell the people about your book.
Yeah, with the unfinished book. I'm still working through the end parts of it, but going to come out next fall. The goal was kind of started as like, hey, let's try to explain basketball, how it works now. And it's kind of evolved into, I just think that the game has just transformed just the ability to space the floor just in so many ways. Like, we basically doubled the length of the practical playing surface in like a decade, maybe less. And I don't think people realize how fundamental a change that is. So like the goal of the book is to sort of be like, okay, like here are all the ways that like basically the three-point era has just transformed things we thought we knew about the game. And here they are. And like, how do we get here? Like right now I'm like kind of working on a chapter on like kind of dribbling and movement and how like just this sort of Euro step gather 1-2 and like kind of the Allen Iverson-esque like kind of hang the ball up and kind of use the dribble the same way. Dribbling it and movement and the way players move is just totally transformed once you open the court up. And it's just something as simple and fundamental as that has just completely changed. And it kind of ranges from like sort of more bigger picture questions, like what is a superstar now, to like more micro skill level things like that, or like shooting form. If you're going to shoot a lot of shots from 25 feet, you can't shoot them the same way as you did when you had to shoot them from 15 feet. So how do players figure that out? So just sort of all these sort of little, I still think we've really grasped like how, I think it's the most fundamental way the game has changed since the shot clock, you know, these last 5 years. Like basketball 5 years ago does not look like it does today. And I think it's hard for us to appreciate. And the goal is to sort of illustrate all the ways it's changed and what they all mean.
Gotcha. You said that comes out next fall, correct?
Yeah, once I actually finish it. it's like the project that never ends.
Sounds good. Hopefully it ends. Like, I am intrigued. Just someone who has read your work for literal years at SB Nation, like, not many people get as deep into basketball as you do. So I've always appreciated that about your work. So I am excited for this never ending book. So when it drops out,
I appreciate it. It'll be real. I mean, I think it'll be really original and cool once it's out. It's just, I mean, how many stories of yours have I edited for? I edited one, right? It was a Trey Young story back in the day. Yes. I mean, you remember how like exacting that editing process was. Now imagine that applied to yourself. That's what this book is.
That explains quite a bit.
Yeah. So it's just, yeah. But I'm really excited for when to finally.
Gotcha. Whenever we get closer to the actual release date and stuff, we have to have you back on to promote it full-fledged. But thank you for coming on. Thank y'all for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe to us if you have not already. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your pods. You can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can find Steve at SteveJones20. You can find Mike at MikePrataNBA. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Avery Bradley gets a lot of money.